Accession number 20506, Reel 1.
Miss Parker, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Streatham in London.
Which year was this?
1933.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Streatham?
No, I was brought up in Surrey, near Reigate. I spent all my formative years there. I went away to boarding school at the age of 9 and finished at the age of 17. And then I was called up as a National Serviceman.
Have you any Second World War memories?
Oh yes, quite a lot, I think, because we lived very close to London. And one had, in fact, we had a throwing bomb land in the front garden of our house, which blew in the hole of the front of the house. That must have been about 1944, I suppose.
What was your address at that time?
We lived in a village called Tadworth, which is very close to Sutton. I don't even know that part of the world. And we had a lot of dogfights going on over the top. You could see what was happening over Croydon Airport at the time. That was getting attacked quite regularly in about 1941. It was very attractive. I mean, I loved it as a schoolboy. I thought it was wonderful. One never had any fear of bombs or anything. One just enjoyed watching what was going on.
What was your address in Tadworth? Can you remember?
Yes, 97 Shelvers Way.
Were there many bombs that fell in Tadworth?
No, we had a flying bomb, I say, in the front garden. We had a few incendiaries which landed in the fields all round us. In fact, one landed in the chicken run with my father when he was actually feeding the chickens at night. And one hit the roof of the house next door. But I mean, they were put out very quickly because they weren't very dangerous. I mean, they were phosphorus bombs, quite small things. In fact, I used to go out in the fields and collect them after you'd find the burnt out cone and the tail fin, which you in the ground, you could bring them home and put them on the mantelpiece.
And did you take much interest in the course of the war?
Yes, I suppose as a schoolboy would. I mean, it's rather like supporting a football team, isn't it? I mean, I think one might have had the odd map and saw what was going on in Africa or in Europe at the end. I was quite conscious because I had one uncle who was in the RAF and another one who was in the Oxford Bucks Light Infantry, who was killed at Nijmegen. So one did sort of get to know a bit about what was going on. But by the end of the war, I was, 11, 12 or something like that? So I knew, I was adult enough to understand what was happening.
What happened to you on leaving school?
After I left school, I spent about 6 months working for a family business, which was a construction company in London. And then I was called up for national service. I joined the Queen's Regiment in Guildford, much to my disgust, because I didn't want to be in the Queen's. I wanted to be in the Light Infantry, because it was sort of my family tradition. And then I did my basic training in the Queen's and was sent to Canterbury, which was the depot for the Home Counties, was it Brigade or Brigade, I suppose, which was consisted of the Buffs, the West Kent, the Queen's, the Surreys, and the Middlesex Regiment, I think. I think that was the... And they all had a central training area in barracks in Canterbury, where you went and joined a potential leader platoon if they thought you were capable of either being an NCO or an officer. And then I was sent to do a 2 or 3 day course at Barton Stacey, which was called Wasby.
How did you cope with the initial training?
I thought it was fun, in a way, because I'd been away as a public schoolboy and spent most of my, from the age of 10 or thereabouts onwards, as a boarder, living away from home. I found it quite easy to cope with. Quite like doing the drill and the sort of rifle range stuff and all that sort of thing, assault courses. No, I found it quite stimulating in a way. I mean, just an extension of school. Then I found the whole of the army an extension of school, because you followed on the same sort of form of discipline, really. And if you could accept the discipline of an organisation, I mean, it was quite easy. I think it was very difficult for some of the children who joined at the age of 17, 18, who'd never been away from home. I remember in the barrack room, we were in one of these huge Victorian barracks with 30 or 40 boys in one room who'd never been away from home, some of them. And it was very interesting that the sort of streetwise chaps who'd often got themselves in trouble and the public schoolboys had a sort of affinity, where the rest were sort of in a corner, in a way, in a fear of being away from a settled environment. I mean, is that understandable to you? I mean,
yes. And then what happened to you at Wasbury?
Well, I did this 3-day course where you either pass or you fail, and I passed. You could be deferred, which meant that if you, I think you commit, you could come back again in 3 months or whatever it was time. I passed Wasbury and then went to Eton Hall as an officer cadet, where I spent 4 months. And passed out from Eton Hall, and I'd applied to join the Down Light Infantry.
What exactly happened to you at Eton Hall?
Well, it was a 4-month course where you did, obviously, the usual infantry basic training. You did signals, you did drill instruction. You were taught, in effect, to lead men. You learned to fire weapons more efficiently and to teach people how to use weapons. In the sense, you taught each other, because you were all being trained to be officers. You learned basic infantry tactics for a second lieutenant. Military law, how to give orders on the parade ground, a general initial basic training for a subaltern, really. The whole principal thing, I suppose, really, was to give you some insight how to lead men. From there, you went to your infantry battalion, obviously, as a very junior officer, where the process continued.
And you went to the Durhams?
I went to the Durhams at Brantsmouth Castle, which is just outside Durham, which was the regimental depot of the Durhams.
Had you wanted to go to the DLI?
Oh, yes, I wanted to join the Light Infantry. I had two friends who were joining the Durhams, somebody called Pat Woodbridge and Peter de la Billière, who's obviously now quite famous. Pat Woodbridge was unfortunately rather badly wounded in Korea, and I mean, we were all national servicemen, so we, at that stage, none of us expected to be professional soldiers. From the depot, which was a wonderful place, it was an old Victorian reproduction castle with peacocks on the lawn. The officer's accommodation was magnificent, and the men lived, the barracks was about 200 or 300 yards away. I was then posted from the depot to the 2nd Battalion in the Durhams, which was in Barnard Castle, Deerbolt Camp. And I then joined the support company and was put in charge of a whole lot of bring gun carriers in typical army organisation, because I knew nothing about mechanical things at all. And I looked after the bring gun carriers, which were used by the support company to carry the machine guns and the mortars and various other things for a very short time. I suppose couldn't have been much more than about a month. I was then posted to Strensel, which was the depot of the Light Infantry at the time, and all the regiments of the Light Infantry were there as a training officer, where you had a platoon of new recruits, which I trained for I don't know what the period was, it must have been 4 to 6 weeks. So I took one course of recruits through Strensel, and then was going to be posted back to the 2nd Battalion, which by then had gone to Germany, and I applied then I was asked if I could go to the 1st Battalion, which then had gone to Korea about a month before. We're talking about 1952, the end of 1952, because I was commissioned in September 52, so this must have been, well, it was around about Christmas time, I suppose, when I left. I went to Korea just at the beginning of 1953, in January 53.
Had you wanted to go to Korea?
Yes, I didn't want to go to the 2nd Battalion, because basically the 2nd Battalion was a battalion of a lot of unfit officers. They were people who, I mean, it's being rather unfair on them, but a lot of them were people whose career was not going to go any further. It was the 2nd Division Battalion, I considered to be the 2nd Division Battalion. And, you know, as a young man of 18, 19, you wanted a bit of adventure, so I thought, well, this would be the thing to do. And I'd done quite well. I was told I'd done well at the depot, so they, you know, I was selected to go, because it was a very, very fine battalion. The 1st Battalion was probably one of the best battalions I'd ever fought in Korea. So then I was had a week's leave, and was then shipped out to Korea.
What was the voyage like?
Wonderful. For a boy who'd never been beyond France, I mean, it was magnificent. You had reasonable accommodation. There were four of us in a cabin. It was very congenial company, it was, to me, I mean, it was luxury. I suppose by modern standards it was appalling, but We four of us lived in a little cabin. We got reasonably well fed. There was a bar, and we first stop was Portside, which was, to me, was a new place. Aden, Colombo, Singapore, Busan. I didn't get off at Busan. I went to Kure, which was the JRBD, Japan Reinforcement Base Depot, where I spent a month, and then I joined the battalion in, I think, end of January 1953.
What were you doing at Kure?
I was sent there for sort of extra training. I don't know why. Well, one of the reasons, I mean, I never asked the question. I was sent there for a month, where we did fairly intensive fitness training. But the reason was, of course, you were being sent out as a replacement officer. And all the time, the officers and men who had gone out with the 1st Battalion were coming home because they'd finished their 2 years national service. So the whole time there was a rotation of new people coming and some coming home. Maybe at the time they didn't need an extra officer, so they sent me there for a month waiting to replace somebody who was going home. Because when I eventually went to Korea, I replaced a chap called Hugh Sawbridge, who went on, found out to be a master at, now which school was it? One of the North London public schools, Haileybury, that's right. And has since died, actually. And I took over his platoon. And he came home having finished his 2 years national service.
Which platoon was that?
Number 8 Platoon, C Company, number 8 Platoon, commanded by Johnny Tresorno, who was a 19-year-old DSO from Sicily. I mean, not 19, obviously, he was about 30-odd when he was commanding the company.
Can you tell me about the men in that platoon, please?
Well, I was told I had the best platoon in the battalion when I took it over. They were a wonderful collection of chaps. They were incredibly tough. Most of them were Geordies. They were very biddable. I mean, I never had any problem with discipline or insubordination, any of that sort of thing. It was, I was incredibly lucky. I had these very tough guys. They were very friendly. They accepted you as an officer and them as other ranks. I say they were tough. I mean, we did a lot of patrolling. For some reason, I used to seem to get the short straw. I found myself out in no man's land with 15 Geordies, more often than most other people. And they were outstandingly good soldiers. They could dig in faster than most of the miners, so they could dig holes as fast as anybody could dig a hole. And very comfortable people to serve with, you know, that's my sort of feeling about it, I think.
And so you were with regulars then?
No, most of them were National Service soldiers. I think my platoon, you know, it's interesting, I cannot remember the name of my platoon sergeant at the time, but I think he would have been a regular, because very few national servicemen rose above the rank of corporal. But most of the platoon were national service. I had one very interesting chap called Corporal Brown, who was a very fine chap, who had been a Royal Marine during the war, and we thought of him as an old man. I think he must have been about 25 or 26. Most of us were 19. I mean, the average age of the platoon was most probably 19 to 21. There was no sort of feeling of the interesting thing, I mean, when I was shipped from Kure to Busan in a funny little boat when I went across. It was the roughest sea voyage I've ever been in my life. I mean, we were actually tied ourselves into our bunks because it was so terrible. And I think I took about a sort of contingent of about 40 or 50 men with me. I think that was all the boat hell. I think there was one other officer on board, I remember. And the interesting thing, I lost my keys going across, and having spent another, 9-10 months in Korea, I was given my keys back by the padre in Busan as we were finally leaving. My trunk was left in storage in Japan. What else do you want?
No, what were your first impressions of Korea?
Total shambles, I think. I can remember arriving initially, before I went on from Busan to the, on a wooden pier, the boat I travelled out in was called the Asturias. And we hit this wooden pier really hard and it sort of shook. And the American band was marching up and down playing When the Saints Come Marching In, a black American band, which I'm sure you've heard of before. They seem to meet every troop ship that arrived in Korea. And then, I didn't get off the boat. I went on to Japan and then came back again. My next journey, I went up. It must have been a transit camp in Busan. I can sort of remember that. And then I took a train journey from Busan up to Seoul, which took, I think, about 24 hours. It was very slow. I went back last year, and I mean, the train journey, I think, takes 3 hours from Busan to Seoul. But it took a good day, I mean, good 24 hours to get there. And Seoul, to me, was a desert of absolute dereliction, really. The whole place was a ruin. I spent one night in a little transit camp, sort of officer's mess transit camp, somewhere in Seoul, where I wouldn't remember where it was. But the only thing I do remember about it was you could hear the guns. It was the first time I ever realised that, you know, one was near a sort of war zone, because the front must have been, what, 30 miles north, I suppose? It's all on the Imjin River, maybe a bit more. But you could hear the sort of larger guns banging away, and you suddenly realised you were quite close to where there was somebody being going to be hurt. The next day I went up to the battalion, and I say, and then joined C Company. Johnny Chisorne was the company commander, and a chap called Guy Griffiths was second in command. And we were in reserve. They'd just come out of the line on I forgot which hill they'd been on, 159, I think. That's all the hills seem to be known by numbers. I spent, I suppose, the first 3 or 4 weeks in a reserve position about 4 or 5 miles behind the then fairly static front line, doing training, and we were building some reserve positions, which I think the line was known as Kansas Line, which was a defensive position which was being built but wasn't in use. And I can remember being very amused by the fact that we had to lay these sandbag emplacements like bricks, and there was a great fuss about the fact that you beat the heavy daylights out of the sandbags to get them to a sort of square position. Stop them falling in when it rained. But I mean, it always struck me as rather sort of superfluous. But it never got used, of course, this position. It was abandoned eventually, because we never withdrew from the positions we were in when I arrived there. Then we moved. I mean, my first experience was of going up into the line was when we took over a position on Hill 355, which is quite a famous hill. It was known as Little Gibraltar, which was held at the time by an American battalion, and I took over from an American platoon commander. The American battalion was known as the Manchu Regiment. I'm sure that's correct. This American, the whole place was very frightening, I remember, because even my company commander, who was Sergeant Major Chadwick, who was a very experienced soldier, said, "We don't want to stay here up here at night, sir, because it's bloody dangerous." Their position had been overrun several times, and it was a mess. My platoon position was the company were on the left hand. Oh, I suppose if I say left hand, that's wrong. I was on the western side of the hill, which was in a way the lowest bit. It was the most uncomfortable place to be because it was very close to the four Chinese hills, very close to us, called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And John was the nearest one. I suppose it was about 500, 600 yards from my first platoon position. But we spent 3 days going up there on a sort of recce, and finding out what happened. And every night we used to go away again because we didn't want to stay up there, because the position next to where my platoon was going to be had been overrun 3 weeks earlier by the Chinese, so it wasn't a very comfortable place. But anyway, we took it over. I moved in up there, and we were up there for 2 or 3 weeks. The Americans had been very bad at patrolling, so the position was that the Chinese were virtually taking over control of no man's land. And we were made to go out and do an awful lot of patrolling. Even the forward companies, which, I mean, you have, as I'm sure you're aware, you have three forward companies and one reserve company. And normally we sent out a listening patrol, which would go out, 150 yards out in front of your positions, and with a telephone line, and sit out there and hope that nothing happened. And then the reserve company would produce fighting patrols, recce patrols that would try and would wander around in no man's land. In the first 2 or 3 weeks, we were up on I was in a forward position with my C company. I've forgotten what happened, but again we then went into you rotate round, and I went back. We went back into a reserve that was as the battalion's reserve company. And found a lot of patrol, because it was the reserve company that sent out patrols, either commanded by a second lieutenant or by a sergeant. Usually 15 men went out as a sort of ambush patrol, and you put yourself out about whatever position you were, wherever you were told to go, and anything up to half a mile in front of the battalion positions, and you sat there hoping or not hoping, as the case may be, that some Chinese might bump into you. There was a lot of patrol activity, a lot of patrols were bumping into Chinese patrols, and we had a lot of, I mean, most of our casualties were patrol actions. I can never remember the right sequence, but we had several of our patrols got ambushed and either got themselves out of it. We had one, a nice chap called Edmund Radcliffe, who was commanding a patrol. His patrol never came back. I get muddled as to the sort of sequence of events. I went out on one patrol, I suppose I don't know, about 3 weeks after being up there, with a fighting patrol. We went out about half a mile, I suppose, wandered around in no man's land, and then we came back. And I mean, I was the luckiest man alive, because one of my soldiers said, look, there's a lot of Chinamen up there, and there was a hill just as we were going in through the mine gap. We used to go out through a mine gap, because we had mines in front of us, and there was a mine gap, and it was just about a couple of hundred yards before I was going up into the mine gap to come back in. And we realised we were being ambushed by the Chinese. And whether God was on my side or not, I don't know, but I had this brainwave. And I said to my guys, we were settled in groups of five, in a sort of, well, difficult to describe, and you have one forward and two either side, so you have a circle of... And I said to my chaps, look, when I give the word, all throw a grenade at where you can see Chinamen, and follow me. And I mean, I suppose it must have been the fact that we preempted their move on us, that we all threw our grenades and moved back about another 50 yards, I suppose. One chap of mine was killed in the first encounter. We think we killed, or we hit, quite a lot of Chinamen. And then we moved back into the, up the mine gap. And the funny thing was, we found the standing patrol, which should have been at the end of the mine gap, and disappeared, and they'd gone back up into the company position above. And we got all our chaps back up. And then one of my fellows was missing. I mean, he was dead, but they didn't know that at the time. And another patrol, patrol from the company whose position we were going back in through, went down to see what had happened down there. And unfortunately, there were still some Chinamen wandering about. And the platoon commander, who was a Pat Woodbridge, was shot in the stomach. I think that was the only casualty they had. But the next morning, or next evening, about three or four dead Chinamen were found, including two quite badly wounded ones who were still lying out there. That was the only serious encounter I had on my first experience, I think, on 355. Though, you know, one was continually being mortared and odd machine gun bullets were coming in and bits of self-propelled guns and things. After that, I mean, having spent three weeks or so on the hill, we then went back into reserve position again. And that, I suppose, was my first month as a sort of infantry officer in a front line in Korea. Does that all sound interesting to you?
Had it been what you had expected?
We're off now, are we?
No.
Oh. I think I thought it would be, you know, one sees war films when you're young, and you thought, God, there'll be shells going on all the time, because most of the time nothing much happens. You don't, you spent most, the sort of things that, you got very tired, because even though you're young and healthy, you very rarely, you slept during the day and you stayed up most of the night. But because you were an officer, or, you know, the officers and the NCOs had things to do all the time, therefore you very rarely got any sleep during the day, and you certainly got very little at night, and therefore, I can remember being incredibly tired. And I can remember lying down one day, it was absolutely sheeting with rain, put my head up against a rock, and the next thing, my batman or something, woke me up and said, you've been asleep for 2 hours, and I was absolutely coming up straight through. I mean, I'd just gone out. It's the tiredness, I think, in a way, you're a little bit on edge. I mean, I don't remember being really frightened. But you're always, obviously... I was more frightened of authority than I was of the enemy. I think that's the way armies operate there. You're much frightened of letting everybody down than you are of anything else. I mean, it's easier, in a way, for people in authority, because you've got a job to do all the time. You've got to give orders and make things happen. It's harder for the men, really, because they have no... all they've got to do is do what they're told. But if you're always busy, you really don't have time to worry about being frightened. I don't really remember being particularly frightened. I mean, obviously, if shells went off close by, you were a bit nervous. And you hated seeing chaps hit, you know, that sort of thing. But the men, I don't think of. I mean, they were so good. I mean, there really was no. You never felt that your men were ever really in a state of shock. I got a thing the other day from the British Korean Veterans Association asking about post-traumatic stress disorder, which I obviously at that stage had never heard of. And I can't think of any of the chaps being really stressed out that they were frightened, except on one case, and I'll tell you. And I had a corporal called Turton, and it's a very sad story, really. He was tough in all boots. He could throw a grenade so far that it went off before it actually hit the ground. I mean, he was a very strong chap. And something broke him. I went on a patrol, and a chap called Nesbitt was killed. And I went back, and I knew he was a friend of Turton's. And I went back and told him, and he collapsed in a sort of physical sense of shock and, I suppose, just distress. He was his friend, you know. And then, I mean, I heard, and I don't think I was there at the time, that he shot himself in the foot, you know. So people did break, but I think very rare. I mean, it's a sad story, really. It was cold, bloody wet sometimes. Well, we were pretty well equipped, and we always seemed to be well fed. I don't remember any feeling of hunger. We had a beer most evenings, and that was a very good thing, really, because you sat around with your men and you all drank your bottle of beer, which was provided. It was Japanese beer, I think. I can't remember what it was called. I tell you the other thing about being a soldier. It was very good for me, who'd been brought up in a sort of middle-class atmosphere where you really didn't meet working-class people close to. I mean, it was the best thing it ever did for me, because you become part of them as well. You understand how they tick, and I think to some degree they understood how you ticked. And you became, I mean, you don't become friends as we would do now, I suppose. In those days, discipline was much more firm. You know, they'd never think of calling you anything else but Sir, and you'd never think of calling them else but Smith or Brown or Jones, whatever their name was. But you did, in a way, become very good close to these chaps, because you lived in holes in the ground with them, you know. And I think it's the best thing it ever did for me as a young man, you know, in the 1950s.
What did you discover about working class attitudes and ways of going on that took you by surprise?
Well, I think in those days there was very little difference between us, because the discipline in working class households was so much better than it is today. I mean, in a way, we were very like each other. I mean, the only difference I had a little bit more. I mean, I'd been brought up with more comfortable surroundings than most of them, bearing in mind there were miners' sons mostly, and therefore had no spare money. But then nobody had any spare money in the 50s. I mean, it was one of the best times. And looking back, everybody is bloody rich now, and in those days, everybody was poor, whether you were, in effect, middle class or poor. I mean, you didn't have spare money. And therefore, we were very alike, really, in a way. You had different experiences because you lived in a bigger house. I mean, I had lived in the south of England, where most of those chaps lived up in, came from Durham. And I was slightly different to them in that respect. I mean, there was a report in the Newcastle Evening News which about this patrol action I was telling you about, where we got ambushed. And one of my chaps came up to say, "You must be bloody famous, sir. You come from Surrey and they put you in a Newcastle newspaper." I mean, we were very alike, and if I see them now, I mean, I find no problem of sitting down and treating them as equals, if you want. I mean, that's not the right way to put it, but I mean, as an ordinary chap you would meet anywhere.
So, if there was so little spare money around, why do you say it was such a good time in the 50s, then?
Because there was no inequality, really. People didn't have... I mean, if you had, I had a little MG, you know, which, I mean, it was a 20-year-old one. I mean, that people didn't have... The lifestyle today is so different from particularly in the southeast of England. I mean, you get my children, and by my standards, earn fortunes in the city. I mean, they work for three, all three of them work in the city. I mean, to me, they have income salaries which are beyond my wildest dreams. I mean, I've never complained that I've lived comfortably all my life, you know, but the gap between the ordinary, I say,